From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, David Petraeus has fallen from grace, but could he come back? Can he find redemption? We'll ask a man who can relate, Elliot Spitzer.
I bring a certain baggage with me as it relates to this issue.
Our cover story, the rise and fall of David Petraeus. Also, an interview with Al Gore on why the next 4 years are crucial in the fight against climate change.
We owe it to ourselves, too. It's affecting us right here and now.
And later, how a young blonde Swiss girl changed American football forever.
I think the modern age of football as the number one sport in the United States begins on this day.
Plus, director Ang Lee stops by to talk life of Pi, the story behind a book vending machine, and the man who revolutionized dance and hip-hop music.
Guess who's coming?
DJ Shadow.
Back again. DJ Shadow's retrospective, that's all in this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. In a few minutes, we're going to go to Gaza for the latest on the escalating violence there between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas. But first to our cover story today, the rise and fall of David Petraeus. Now, the story has developed a kind of supermarket tabloid quality, and that's not what we plan to explore here, but rather what the Petraeus story says about us and about the hope for redemption. In a moment, a man who had his own very public fall from grace, former New York Governor Elliot Spitzer, will weigh in. But first to a journalist who wrote a mea culpa of sorts about Petraeus this past week. His name is Spencer Ackerman, and he covers national security for Wired. Ackerman first met Petraeus in 2005, and this week he wrote that he was, quote, punked by the Petraeus machine and that he became, in effect, part of that machine that perpetuated a myth.
The myth was that Petraeus, already an exceptionally talented and capable army officer, was larger than life, was superhuman. And I had found Petraeus, you know, during that time as a younger reporter, just a tremendously impressive army officer and someone who was far more willing than nearly everyone else to engage in the candid back and forth that, you know, reporters tend to value as a mark of integrity. And I think that probably blinded me a little bit too much to some of the more critical questions about the Iraq war and about counterinsurgency and the ultimately created this legend around Petraeus.
And full disclosure, I did a profile on him in 2003 in Mosul and similarly felt he was an impressive person. I mean, this is somebody that knew the name of every reporter who ever interviewed him, and I would see him every year or so after that up until 2009, 2010. He always remembered my name and yours as well, as you write.
And I think it's important to emphasize that the Broadwell affair only touches on a certain aspect of that Petraeus myth. His actual record in Iraq and Afghanistan speaks for itself. And now that the myth is a little bit punctuated, it might be time for some critical reappraisal.
Speaks for itself in that it wasn't as successful as it appeared at the time?
Certainly Afghanistan was not as successful as his tenure in Iraq. I don't mean to say that Petraeus was a poor army officer, but it does seem to merit the reassessment that the myth that he cultivated, that his allies cultivated to build him up, was ultimately the cause of what seems to be the affair that doomed him at the CIA.
Okay, why would an extramarital affair prompt you to reassess his career now? I mean, what is different about your thinking about Petraeus this week than it was 10 days ago?
It's an excellent question, and the candid answer I'd offer to you is that it got me thinking about what separated Petraeus the man and Petraeus the record from Petraeus the public figure and Petraeus the myth. And the record ought to be its own thing. And when I went back and looked at some of my reporting, I wondered if I had allowed myself to be less than fully critical about him. And so that's why I wanted to write that piece, to sort of take stock when we look at the way the media presentation of Petraeus contributed to building him up to this kind of superhuman figure.
Because he was willing to go for jogs with you, he invited you along, and he would always make himself available when you would seek a quote or an interview?
Yeah, more or less, that he cultivated an image of candor, of disclosure, of openness. And I wanted to kind of remind myself and hopefully inform readers that we can't let that as reporters overshadow what these life and death issues are. And I think it's also important to point out that, you know, both Presidents Bush and Obama used Petraeus in that way precisely because he had this aura around him. Bush in Iraq, you know, had Petraeus, you know, testify at this crucial moment legislatively about the Iraq surge, and Obama sent Petraeus to Afghanistan after General McChrystal imploded. And that probably as well took away some of the critical focus about the strategies in these wars and used Petraeus as a bit of insulation.
Spencer Eckerman, he covers national security for Wired. Spencer, thanks.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
Michelle Cottle is a reporter for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and she recently wrote a provocative article arguing, in effect, against what she sees as the hypocrisy surrounding our assessment of David Petraeus's personal foibles.
We're talking about a guy who's a total alpha male. You know, he spent half his career getting shot at, and the other part was tracking down the worst of worst guys. On some level, the kind of men who we generally ask to do those jobs are also the kind of men who are going to have, like, big egos and a lot of testosterone and take the kind of risk that will land you in this situation. So as far as, like, all of the people yammering at him about, oh, my God, you know, this is such a betrayal, whatever, I'm not sure that we ought to just take a step back and be a little less judgmental.
And Cottle believes Petraeus should not have had to step down. Frank Farley, a psychologist at Temple University, more or less agrees. He studies the cult of heroes, and in a recent article in Psychology Today, he writes that careers in politics and in the military often attract risk-takers. He points to great leaders who led very flawed personal lives, generals like Eisenhower and Patton and MacArthur, presidents like FDR, JFK, and Bill Clinton.
So my sense is that the American public looks at it with a prurient interest, might connect a few dots in terms of their own life, and so on, but moves on. And JFK and FDR remain in the top heroes lists despite everything that we know about them. And Bill Clinton is certainly one of the world's most popular global leaders. So I think the American people have a certain perspective on this, which is that that's private and it's interesting and they shouldn't do it. But I'm more concerned about what they've done for the country politically and in terms of leadership.
For former New York Governor Elliot Spitzer, the Petraeus affair was a reminder in many ways of his own promise and his own fall from grace. Up until he was embroiled in a scandal that exposed liaisons with prostitutes, Spitzer was a rising star in the Democratic Party, a man many believed uniquely qualified to take on the excesses and abuses of Wall Street executives. But that promise came to a rapid end in early 2008. I asked Elliot Spitzer first how he thought President Obama should have handled the Petraeus case.
I wish the president had looked at General Petraeus and said, "General, you have sinned and violated your oath to your wife, and you will have to deal with that and make reparations and probably suffer the public sentiment that results from that. But I expect you to continue to serve this nation. Nothing you have done diminishes your capacity to serve as director of the CIA. I believe that you are uniquely equipped to fulfill that mission, and I ask you to do so. And I will be supportive of you in that mission because we need your wisdom in that capacity."
I'm curious to ask you about personal mistakes and recovering from it. I mean, here you have this incredibly talented man with a certain set of skills that are unprecedented. I mean, some would say he was perfect for the job. And yet this episode would seem to remove a talented person from that position. You have been there. How do you recover from it?
Well, look, let me state the obvious. I bring a certain baggage with me as it relates to this issue, and so on. Obviously everything I say should be understood through the prism of my experience, and so people might think, therefore, I have additional thoughts on this that are interesting, or perhaps my thoughts should be discounted as a consequence. And so I want everybody to understand I appreciate that, to state the obvious. I think that there are and can be separate spheres of analysis. People have erred, sinned, violated obligations in different domains. As you just said, I think General Petraeus is a uniquely talented individual when it comes to the military, when it comes to his intelligence capacities. Not that I have agreed with each of his strategic calls in Afghanistan or elsewhere, of course, but he is uniquely talented. And not to be able to separate the strands of his life and to recognize that the public should get the benefit of his talents in one domain, even if there have been flaws or failures elsewhere, I think is to unfortunately deprive the public of a unique talent. Now, how does one come back from events like this? I think it is difficult either to generalize. I know, and here I will speak only from what I have tried to do, which is to focus on those issues, matters, individuals whom I care most about, and lead life. That is all one can do.
Do you think, as a society, we cope with personal mistakes of public officials in ways that are unfair?
I do not think I can judge the fairness of it for the obvious reasons. I think the public, frankly, is entitled to judge public officials by the entirety of their existence. When one stands for elective office or a point of office, the entirety of one's life is subject to scrutiny. So I appreciate that and think the public fairly can do so. I think people can and perhaps should weight different aspects of those lives in different ways. And I think that is the question that people should ask, for instance, with General Petraeus, whether his breach here should be considered a disqualifying factor, which in my view, it's too bad it has been viewed that way. I think that it is a question of the balance. It is not a question of segmenting and compartmentalizing lives in their entirety. I think it is a matter of coming up with an appropriate balance of the factors that are legitimately weighed and not being so – speaking with such certitude that any violation in one domain is a disqualifying factor. And I think in truth our history is a bit more subtle than that if you look back at the history. But certainly at this moment a rather harsh glare has been put on General Petraeus and he is suffering the consequences of a calculus that I think is a bit off.
You transitioned to television and you have used that as a way to criticize Wall Street. What do you think Petraeus could do to continue to work on behalf of U.S. national security, if anything?
Well, I still do not put it beyond reason that the president could say we have completed an investigation and on further consideration we have asked General Petraeus to come back in some capacity, maybe not as the director of the CIA, but in some advisory capacity in the White House where his knowledge could be tapped. There are many positions at the Pentagon and outside government, the official government advisory positions where his thoughts, wisdom could be utilized. And I would hope that's what would happen.
Well, Governor Spitzer, I appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
That's former New York Governor Elliot Spitzer. He now hosts Viewpoint on Current TV. Stay with us in a moment, an interview with former Vice President Al Gore and how the story of Heidi changed sports history forever on this day in 1968. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Looming over all of these world events is one big issue that was largely ignored on the campaign trail this year, climate change. And much of that has to do with the economic crisis of the past 4 years. This week, former Vice President Al Gore argued that now the election is over, President Obama should use his mandate to begin to take a hard look at the issue of climate change. I spoke with a former vice president this week and asked him what he proposes.
I think it should be the top priority. I do understand fully that a solution for this near-term problem of the fiscal cliff is going to occupy their attention. I'm under no illusions about that, but that's going to be dealt with in fairly short order.
Explain how, if you were in the same position, and let's talk about this president for a moment. He faces essentially a Congress, as you know, in which a large number of the members either deny the reality of climate change or deny that it's man-made. So how would you sort of see the president trying to convince that part of the Congress to support potentially serious measures to tackle it?
Well, it's not the first time that we've faced political difficulty in trying to solve a really important challenge. And that's one of the reasons we have a president in our Constitution, to lead the country. And if I could gently challenge part of your premise, I believe that there has been some movement, both in public opinion and among some Republicans. I've heard them say it. Many of them say it privately, and fewer of them say it publicly. But I think that in the aftermath of the historic drought that affected 65% of our country this year, in the wake of Hurricane Sandy and the superstorm it became, only 1 year after another so-called once-in-a-100-year storm also devastated the Northeast. After the horrific fires in the American West last year, after $10 billion plus climate-related disasters that have wreaked havoc in so many states, it is now a reality that is very difficult to deny. And I think that more and more people in both political parties are taking a hard look at it and saying, yes, we really do need to do something.
What if nothing is done over the next 4 years? What do you believe the consequences of that would be?
Well, the scientific community is in a better position than I am to answer that question. But you've probably heard them say, as I have, that the longer we wait, the heavier the consequences will be, the more risk we run, and the more difficult it will be what we're eventually going to have to do anyway. We put 90 million tons of global warming pollution into the atmosphere every day as if it's an open sewer. It traps as much energy every 24 hours as the equivalent energy from 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs. It's a big planet, but that's a lot of energy. And that's what's making the storms stronger. That's what's making the droughts deeper. That's what's making the floods more destructive. That's what's changing the weather patterns. So we can wish it away. We can pretend it doesn't exist. But none of that changes the reality. We have to deal with the reality.
Your film, An Inconvenient Truth, had an enormous impact on public opinion in the United States. And then over the next few years after that, you saw how the belief in climate change once again became very controversial, that many people stopped believing that it was something that was real or that was man-made. Did that discourage you?
Well, the economic crisis certainly intervened, but at no point was there less than a majority saying that we've got to act on this, and it's back up now nearly to 70%. And again, regardless of what the polls say or the political analyses imply, it's reality. We've got to deal with it.
That's former Vice President and Nobel Peace Prize recipient Al Gore. Mr. Vice President, thank you.
Thank you.
Today happens to mark a significant turning point in sports history, and it happened in 1968 with help from a little blonde girl.
I think the modern age of football as the number one sport in the United States begins on this day.
Dave Zirin is not that little blonde girl. He's the sports editor of The Nation, and he's talking about the Heidi game. And that game was one of the most anticipated of the season.
It's the New York Jets against the Oakland Raiders.
Two of the best teams in the old American Football League just before it merged with the NFL. The game was so important that NFL Films eventually made a documentary about it, and here's how it went down.
The lead changed back and forth six times before the score was finally tied at 29-all. Then the Jets' Jim Turner kicked a 26-yard field goal, and the Jets had the lead with 1 minute 5 seconds left.
New York was ahead 32-29 and seemed to have the game sewn up. Jets fans watching at home were on the edges of their seats.
You're excited, but you're also nervous because the Raiders have an amazing vertical offensive game. They throw the ball deep. They throw the ball well.
With just a minute 5 to go, Raiders quarterback Daryl LaMonica hit Charlie Smith on a 20-yard pass. A penalty got the Raiders another 15 yards, and with 50 seconds to go, Oakland was within striking distance of a touchdown. And then,
boom, Heidi begins. A little girl with braids in the Swiss Alps starts walking down a hill.
When I am wishing for dreams to come true.
Heidi, the made-for-television children's movie NBC's scheduled to air at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, did in fact air, as promised, right at 7 p.m., and it cut off the final 50 seconds of what would become one of the greatest football games of all time.
I don't want you here.
I don't want to be here either.
It was the sort of thing that was so shocking that as Art Buchwald put it, the great humorist, he said, men who would not get out of their armchairs for earthquakes made their way to the phone to call into NBC.
NBC's phone bank was overwhelmed with angry callers. What are you doing? They asked, as the young Heidi danced across an alpine landscape on their television screens. Meanwhile, in those final 50 seconds, the Raiders scored two thrilling touchdowns in less than a minute, and it gave Oakland one of the most unlikely come-from-behind victories in football history, and most of the country missed it.
Harmonica to Charlie Smith, and he scores!
NBC was shocked by the fan reaction. Executives there just didn't see it coming, and the Heidi game would forever change the power dynamic between sports leagues and television networks. Again, here's Dave Zirin.
The networks still saw themselves as the ultimate vehicle for this product, and that the NFL would have to conform itself to the networks. But after this day, they learned it would actually be television that would have to conform to the National Football League.
Angry fans flooded the network with hate mail that made it all the way to London, where the child actress who played Heidi lived.
10-year-old Jennifer Edwards, who is somewhat Hollywood royalty. I mean, she's the daughter of Blake Edwards, the stepdaughter of Julie Andrews. And she was somebody who looked like she was going to have really a toboggan ride into a successful
right.
Hollywood career.
Yes, down that Swiss alpine slope.
Yes.
And I remember feeling that, well, it wasn't my fault.
That is Heidi, Jennifer Edwards. We reached her in Los Angeles.
And a lot of the commentaries weren't very nice, which was a little bit heartbreaking for a 10-year-old. I remember one caption in some paper that said something about the little brat in white stockings that ruined the football game.
Jennifer Edwards has since recovered from that traumatic experience, and she's still amazed at the lasting impact of the Heidi game. People constantly ask her about it. And at one point in the 1970s, the producers of The Love Boat wanted her to come on the show. Edwards would play herself, and she'd meet Jets quarterback Joe Namath on the boat, and they'd fall in love. Well, thankfully, that episode didn't pan out. But Edwards did finally meet Joe Namath face-to-face about 5 years ago.
We were on the same plane together, and we were sitting, each of us in an aisle seat, across from each other. At one point, I leaned over and I said, "Do you remember the Heidi game?" And he looked at me, you know, like, well, duh. And I said, "Well, I want to formally introduce myself. I'm Heidi." I think he and I should do Dancing with the Stars.
Totally. I hope they're listening.
I hope so, too.
Jennifer Edwards, she starred as Heidi in the NBC made-for-television movie that was aired on this day in 1968. Director Ang Lee's new film, Life of Pi, tells the story of a 16-year-old Indian boy, the lone survivor of a shipwreck, who finds himself lost at sea, alone on a boat with a Bengal tiger.
We were both raised in a zoo by the same master. Now we've been orphaned, left to face our ultimate master together.
The film is based on Jan Martel's fantasy novel of the same name. That novel won the Man Booker Prize for fiction and was quickly optioned by Hollywood producers. But many in Hollywood didn't think it could be made. I mean, how do you make a movie set almost entirely on a boat in the middle of the ocean with a real tiger? That was a question Ang Lee asked himself. He loved Martel's book, so even though he knew it would be a challenge, he decided to take it on. One step at a time.
Technically, how do you do a boy and a tiger on a boat? And water movie is among the most difficult one. And then Adrift without Tom Hanks.
Yeah, that's Tom Hanks could not play Pi.
It's not like Castaway of Tom Hanks. Established movie stars, obviously, a 16-year-old Indian boy. And physically, it's pretty hard to pull it off, too. Now, how do you do the tiger?
Yeah.
Digitally, 10 years ago when it came out, it's pretty impossible.
You mean when the book came out 10 years ago, people, that technology wasn't there yet.
It wasn't there when I started doing this movie.
Let's talk about the technology because this is a 3D movie. I mean, most people think of 3D movies as blockbusters or Disney movies or, you know, James Cameron type films. This is a highbrow film in 3D.
I think 3D is actually great for drama. It just wasn't recognized that way because it's expensive to do and naturally go to action movies. But I found it's a valuable tool to tell story.
What were you able to do in 3D, or what did it bring to the film, in your view, that you wouldn't get if it was a two-dimensional film?
Most obviously, water.
And underwater, too. There are beautiful shots underwater.
Water and underwater. Yeah. Anything that's moving, when it brings out to your eyes, you feel you exist there.
The majority of the film takes place in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, a boy and a tiger on a raft.
My name is Pai Patel. I have been in a shipwreck. I am on a lifeboat alone with the tiger.
The tiger's name is Richard Parker, for anybody who's read Jan Martel's novel. What's that tiger, real? I mean, it looked real.
Some of them are real. Yeah, we'll have four tigers. We brought four to Taiwan to make this movie. And most of them are CG tigers. But I believe you cannot tell the difference.
You can't tell the difference. That's what's incredible.
The good thing about bringing real tigers, not only they look real and they're cheaper than CG tigers, but they left a lot of good references for the animators. When we go about CG tigers, we know exactly how it moved down to every hair and muscle. We learn a great deal from the living tigers.
I'm speaking with the acclaimed director Ang Lee. His new film is an adaptation of the novel Life of Pi. It's also called Life of Pi. I'm fascinated by, not just by this film, but also by your personal story. And I know you've been on NPR before and you've talked a little bit about it, but I mean, it is amazing. You grew up in Taiwan, and you came to film school here. You didn't speak English that well, and you got your BA, and then you went to film school, and you became one of the most successful directors ever in Hollywood. I mean, do you ever think about how unlikely that was going to be?
Well, it happened over, like, 20 years. At times, I felt it's pretty incredible. Most of the time, I just try to make the scenes work. Trying to overcome obstacles, and somehow things work out. I don't know.
it seems like you are always testing your comfort level. I mean, you go back and you look at your career, Wedding Banquet and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Those, of course, touch on Chinese culture. But then you go to Sense and Sensibility. I mean, a classic of English literature, to The Ice Storm and Brokeback Mountain. Now a film that deals almost primarily with Indian culture. How do you do that?
I don't know. I got sucked into those stories. They're so fascinating, I forgot to be afraid of them. I got hired to do Sense and Sensibility. I was very scared. Yeah, I never done period piece. I never done English job. I never worked in the so-called major league productions. I had a big learning curve. I spoke pretty not real fluent English back then. If I could do that movie, if I can get over that, anything is possible. Yeah. That was very encouraging. After that, I was afraid that if I stay in one place doing same type of movies, and I'll be pigeonholed, and I'll have a very limited career. I was scared that that might happen. Mm. So I have to take an adventure to keep myself energetic.
I read that after you made The Hulk, which, again, was a huge departure because it's a blockbuster and it's a cultural touchstone and a huge comic book character, a big budget, that you actually thought about retiring as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I was exhausted. After that movie and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it's a 5 years of my life, I thought of retiring. And Hulk was related to violence and anger. You know, I didn't treat it like a entertaining blockbuster comic book movie. I treat it like psychodrama. So it really took a lot out of me.
I read that it was your father who actually convinced you not to retire, but this was the same father who urged you to become a professor and not a filmmaker.
Yeah. Well, it's more respectful than entertainer, filmmaker. That's more acceptable, so to speak.
I assume that he came around eventually.
Yeah. Retire is worse than being a professor at the age of 49. He said it's a bad example for your kid. So go ahead, make another movie. That's for the first time he was encouraging in terms of filmmaking. He passed away shortly after that. And I had to finish that movie, Brokeback Mountain. And that's a movie about love. And I really dedicate that movie to him.
Hmm. When you look ahead to the rest of your career, it seems like you have fought against and successfully fought against being pigeonholed. Can you imagine doing another huge blockbuster on the scale of Hulk or something I mean, this was a huge film, obviously, but can you imagine doing that or veering off in a completely radical direction? And what would that direction be?
I have no idea. I'm so drained and blanked out now. I just try to survive this one, just emotionally, spiritually. I'm not a master of films, but I'm rather a slave. When something possessed me, I go ahead and do it. Sometimes I felt it's the movies that direct me, not the other way around. So I'm just waiting for the next thing that grasps me.
As director Ang Lee, his new film, Life of Pi, opens in theaters on November 21st. Ang Lee, thank you so much. Congratulations on this film.
Thank you.
So this past week, we called up the Monkeys Pod. It's a used bookstore in Toronto.
Monkeys Pod?
Well, we caught Stephen Fowler, the owner,
okay,
right in the middle of his workday.
Hi. Sorry.
But he took a few minutes to tell us about a remarkable addition he recently made to his store, a vending machine for used books. It was an idea that hit him a few months back.
Originally I thought maybe we would just have a refrigerator box and put a skinny assistant of mine inside and have him drop books out when people put a coin in. But
then he was hanging out with a friend.
A friend of mine, Craig Small.
Craig runs an animation studio in town.
And I mentioned the idea to him, and he said, well, forget it. Let's just build one. Real mechanical vending machine.
And for the past few weeks, that machine has been up and running. Stephen Fowler calls it the Bibliomat. It's coin-operated. It's about the size of a refrigerator. It's painted vintage pistachio green with chrome accents. And on the front, written in old-style lettering.
Every book is surprised. No two alike. Collect all 112 million titles.
Now, it's also an easy way for Stephen to offload books from his dollar bin. And he says, imagine being a kid and walking up to this thing.
One kid I can think of in particular. Very intense, physical little boy. Not what you would necessarily consider the bookish type. He got a weird local history, probably 1940s or 1950s local history book about Hamilton, Ontario. And apparently he's been carrying it around his house, you know, asking his mom, oh, you know, did you see where I left my Hamilton book? So, yeah, I don't know. It's like it completely re-injects the mystery into these old printed artifacts.
That's Stephen Fowler, owner of the Monkeys Paw Bookstore in Toronto. Of course, we couldn't let him go.
You want to hear it?
Without a demonstration.
Absolutely. I wonder if it would be best to put the phone on speaker. Okay, hold on just a second, please. All right, there you go. Hold on just a second. Let me dig it out. Okay, we got the shocking truth about water. I don't actually know what that is. I think it's some kind of a health book.
And you can check out a video of Stephen Fowler's Bibliomat book vending machine at our website, npr.org. And it's time now for music. In 1996, this album revolutionized hip-hop.
Ooh, hold up, before we get started.
Guess who's coming?
It's...
Guess who's coming?
It's...
Guess who's coming?
DJ Shadow.
All of the sounds you're hearing right now, all of them are samples. The sounds were cobbled together mainly from old vinyl records. As a matter of fact, almost every note on the entire album was produced that way. The man behind it is Josh Davis, better known as DJ Shadow.
I call it a collage. I think that's the best way to explain it to people. It's taking little pieces from here, adding it to little pieces from there, you know, literally down to not just the drums from one record, but the snare from one record, the kick from another record, and making something totally new out of it.
The result of his work was the groundbreaking album, Introducing. It's been more than 15 years since Introducing was released, and DJ Shadow is enjoying this sort of milestone usually reserved for artists like John Coltrane or the Beatles. His combined work is being released as a box set. It's called Reconstructed. Josh Davis grew up in the suburbs of Sacramento and San Francisco, where he idolized the early heroes of hip-hop. And when he began as a DJ, he wanted to bring the art of sampling out from under the shadows.
I think initially in the late 80s when the technology was made available, the instant reaction to it by the old guard at that time was, well, this is just out-and-out theft. But I think what introducing did for a lot of people was kind of close the book on that discussion and say, okay, this is legitimate. This is a legitimate new way of making music.
The second track on the record, it was called Building Steam with a Grain of Salt. Can we sort of listen through that? And can you tell us what all those bits are? So it begins like this.
Producing.
Okay, well, it's a piano from a record by a guy named Jeremy Storch. And again, one of the knocks on sampling is that, well, you just take famous songs that everybody knows and replay, you know, the chorus over and over. Well, obviously, in this case, I've taken a rather obscure artist. Part of the aesthetic is taking great moments from basically forgotten music history and reapplying it with a new context.
And you've got the spoken word over that.
I'd like to just continue to be able to express myself as best as I can.
That's a gentleman named George Marsh, drummer from the Bay Area. And there was an instructional record about music, and he was interviewing some of his favorite drummers. It's from, I think, about 74.
Wow. And then you've got that sound.
Yeah. I'm struggling at the moment off the top of my head to remember where that came from. It might actually come from the Jeremy Storch record, but I'm not 100% sure.
And then that percussion.
The percussion is from a high school record. In the 60s and 70s, primarily, you know, any local high school or college would, in addition to having a yearbook, the school would pay to press 500 copies of the school band and what they were up to. That's where the drums come from.
Where would you find these records? You just pick them up at a record store. They were, you know, maybe 50 cents or 75 cents and just buy them and just on a whim and see if they work?
Sure. Sure, in some cases. But in other cases, I mean, you start to develop kind of a sense of things that are going to make it, you know, increase the odds of having something fruitful within the grooves. You start looking for certain labels. You start looking for certain producers. I mean, one of the first things that I realized is that anything prior to 1966 probably wasn't going to have what I was looking for, because once James Brown invented funk, then music began to settle into kind of a 4/4 groove, which is what hip-hop is based on.
I'm speaking with Josh Davis. He's better known as DJ Shadow. The new retrospective of his career is called Reconstructed. Tell me about how you got into this. I mean, you grew up in California, relatively small town. Mm-hmm. You are white, and this has been predominantly an African-American musical genre. Presumably hip-hop was what you listened to as a kid growing up.
I grew up in a household that tended to reject the mainstream. And my listening habits were primarily R&B. I mean, I was able to tune into an R&B station from San Francisco on my AM little portable radio. Hmm. So I was listening to, you know, Lakeside and the Gap Band and Kool and the Gang and Evelyn Champagne King. I mean, a lot of post-disco, so basically 80 to 82 or so. And then they played The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And it was just one of those moments.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
You know, if you're a punk kid and the first time you heard Minor Threat or Bad Brains, I mean, you know, through any kind of underground musical genre, everybody has these moments. Yeah. It was just one of those moments in my life where I felt as though at 10 years old I was hearing music for the first time, and I was hearing something that wasn't my parents, and it wasn't anybody's, it didn't feel like, because nobody had really, it was undefined at that time. Don't push me, 'cause I'm close to the edge. This was an East Coast phenomenon, primarily a New York City phenomenon. Growing up in a small town, you had to just grab these little glimpses where you could. And what it did for me was it became kind of an obsession about, you know, this culture that wasn't all around me. It was something that was, you know, seemed so distant, and it seemed so obviously vital, yet so out of reach.
Introducing, and I know people have said this to you many times, you know, it was such an important record for me when I first heard it 16 years ago. I'd never heard anything like it. And it occurred to me when I was preparing for this interview that I had never seen a photograph of you. I mean, there are not many glamour shots, just photo after photo of you. And it occurred to me that you're kind of an Oz figure. I mean, you are really your name, like a shadow hidden behind a turntable. Are you reluctant to be the star?
I just think it interferes a lot of times with just being able to communicate the music. For me, the music is the message. And also growing up, the DJ tended to be relegated to the background, and I was kind of okay with that. Famously, you know, Run DMC, Jam Master Jay was always in shadow.
Is that why you became Shadow?
Yeah, that's really what the name comes from, actually. I mean, there was a moment where famous hip-hop producers in the 80s, such as Marley Marl and another guy named Herbie Lovebug, were getting deals where they were doing their own albums, and they were on the front covers. And I remember thinking, I'm not so sure I agree with the way this is progressing. I'm comfortable in the studio environment. I don't want to be out there having to worry about fashion and stuff like that. You know, that sounds really kind of ridiculous even as I'm saying it. I mean, that's just not what I'm into. It's not where my head's at.
Josh, recently somebody wrote that your first record, Introducing, this is a quote, altered the landscape of hip-hop forever. I mean, you know this, that critics have called you one of the most influential figures in hip-hop. Is that strange when you hear that?
I mean, I'm not so sure I agree 100% with that sentiment anyway. I mean, I'm not so sure it changed hip-hop so much as it did introduce a lot of previously hip-hop-wary listeners to a new universe. You know, some people called it trip-hop. Some people just sort of fit it into electronica. I mean, I definitely, you know, growing up on hip-hop, I've always tried to do work that would provide an alternative because I think that's how things change and evolve. Yeah, I am trying to change music. I don't know that I'm trying to change hip-hop necessarily, though.
Josh Davis is the music producer, better known as DJ Shadow. He's released a retrospective of his career in two different forms, one as a single album and two as a massive box set. Both are called Reconstructed. Josh Davis, DJ Shadow, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Ending November 18th, 2012. That's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Acacia Squires, and Brenda Salinas. Our intern is Barbara Sprunt. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Methoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for tuning in.